All right, thank you. We will now move to the fourth case of this morning, which is United States against Walter Fox and Mr. Sykes, Rodney Sykes.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Attorney Erica Biermo, appearing specially for Attorney Kelly Welsh, appearing for the appellant, Rodney Sykes.
Tinkers to Evers to Chance.
Your Honors, the district court in this matter clearly erred when the district court found that the record supports the role enhancement in this matter. Mr. Sykes challenged the role enhancement in the district court. He also challenged the pre-sentence report through his objections. And Rule 32 requires that the district court resolve controverted facts, and the district court did not decide any of these controverted facts. The district court made erroneous findings as well in this matter. The district court stated that the evidence clearly shows that Sykes provided the crack to Fox, who made the delivery. At least that's what Fox is saying. That's what the district court stated. That is not what Fox said at the time of his plea.
But didn't the district court, well, first of all, we're here on clear error review for this sort of thing. And I thought that the district court was essentially relying on the pre-sentence report, and that it seemed fairly clear that that various people delivered these drugs for Mr. Sykes. Sanderson does sometimes, you know, Fox apparently does on the one occasion, maybe some other unidentified person, and the district court, it's only a two-level, I mean, not that anything is trivial, but it's a two-level increase. On that record, how can it be clear error to say that he deserves that characterization?
Well, Your Honor, the pre-sentence report, the way that Mr. Sykes' statement was summarized in the pre-sentence report is not accurate, and it's also taken completely out of context, because the reports that the U.S. probation officer used in compiling that paragraph of the pre-sentence report takes Mr. Sykes' statement out of context, because Mr. Sykes provided approximately an hour and a half long statement to law enforcement, and the report was summarized in less than three quarters of a page. And in the district court objections, when the district court had a summary more detailed than what was contained in the pre-sentence report in the district court's objections, the objection said that when he was asked if Fox delivered for him, he answered with a question. He said, "Running dope for me?" question. Says, and then Detective Linsmeyer says, "Yeah, delivering dope for you." Then he says, "Walter don't deliver no dope for me. Walt don't deliver no dope at all. He gets high." And then they go on to talk to him, and they try through this conversation, which obviously isn't in the pre-sentence report but was contained in the objections, the detectives are trying to get him to admit that he was in some kind of supervisory managerial role in this, but he keeps saying that, you know, he said, "Why are you trying to make it look like I'm a leader?" And that's, you know, we would assert that Sykes is no more culpable than Fox or Mr. Sanderson. And in this matter, there were six counts, and there's only two transactions that were alleged to have been involving Mr. Fox or Mr. Sanderson, and there's no evidence in the record to support the fact that Mr. Sykes directed Mr. Fox or directed Mr. Sanderson to...
I thought the evidence... I mean, the court says, I'm looking at the sentencing transcript, that it was actually... let's say Mr. Sykes wasn't entirely consistent in the way that he described these transactions. The court saying to defendant, meaning Sykes, you know, first indicated that Fox didn't deliver the drugs, then he said if he was delivering them, it wasn't for Sykes. Later on, he says he refers drug customers to Fox and Sanderson. Then he eventually says maybe he contacted Fox. I mean, so there's more to the record than just that one little exchange that you've identified.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in terms of reliability, if the court has concern with Mr. Sykes' statement, Mr. Fox's own admission at the time of his plea is very reliable under oath. He says that the district court questions Fox and says, "Where was your source? How did you get it? Who gave it to you? How did you get it for distribution?" And Fox answers, "Well, I ended up purchasing the crack cocaine." there's nothing in Mr. Fox's admission that acknowledges that he was ever directed by Sykes, that he was ever told to do anything by Sykes, and that was under oath in the district court. Furthermore, in looking at the objections to the pre-sentence report, there's nothing that evidenced that Mr. Sykes exercised any kind of decision-making, as in the commentary of 3B1.1 of the guidelines. It looks as though they were all equally culpable. And I guess I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You've just used it up, but that's how it goes. Thank you very much.
If I may, Your Honor, then I would also respectfully request a remand on Kimbrough, because Kimbrough and Clanton had been decided after this case. And thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Jones?
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is William Jones from Madison, Wisconsin. I represent Walter Fox in this appeal. Mr. Fox brought his appeal based upon an erroneous guideline calculation. A drug amount that was found in Rodney Sykes' house was used in Mr. Fox's relevant conduct. This involved an indictment that alleged a conspiracy among certain defendants between June 1st and June 22nd. Mr. Fox pled guilty to being part of that conspiracy, and at that plea, Judge Shabazz asked him what his role in the conspiracy was, and he said, "Your Honor, I was a member. According to count one, on the 13th, I did deliver crack cocaine." And he said, "On the 13th, you didn't?" And Mr. Fox said, "No, I did." And he said, "You did? Yes, Your Honor." And that's the extent of his, you know, the colloquy that they had.
But, I mean, as most indictments do, this one said something to the effect of on or about. And then once we're at the sentencing stage, what we're assessing isn't guilt of the conspiracy. It's really to what degree should somebody be punished, which is where 1B1.3 comes in with relevant conduct. And we're talking about 5 days after the end of the conspiracy. It seems to me that that's well within the range of other relevant conduct findings and the type of finding that's often made under that section.
Well, I would disagree. The only evidence that would support a conspiracy is one that occurred on the 13th. Someone called Mr. Sykes. They had called Mr. Sykes before that day and called him after for deliveries, and Mr. Fox was not involved at all. But on the 13th, he did appear and deliver an eighth of an ounce.
An ounce.
And
unfortunately, we all know these things.
Yes, it is. But my point really is that I filed an objection to the PSR. I filed a sentencing memorandum. I made oral argument all that this was not in furtherance of a continued criminal activity or continued operation, and no one seemed to really care. They just worried about foreseeability. Yeah, I'm sure Mr. Fox was not shocked to hear that when they finally raided Mr. Sykes' home, they found crack cocaine in it. He had used crack cocaine with him. He has a drug addiction, and Mr. Sykes was a source for him to use. So, but all anyone really concerned themselves about foreseeability. So, to anyone who would care to listen, I said, "But what about the first question, which is, was this in furtherance of a jointly undertaken criminal activity?" And I'd say, "No, that jointly undertaken criminal activity was on June 13th."
Well, he didn't plead guilty to a June 13th conspiracy, though. He pleaded guilty to the conspiracy charged in the indictment, I would assume.
He did plead guilty to being part of a conspiracy, but I do cite case law that says, you know, there's a further, you know, that's a general conspiracy charge. You have to do a further investigation, and there was none about what was his role. When was his entry and exit into that conspiracy of that generally charged?
It's actually rather hard, as I'm sure you know, to withdraw from conspiracies. And the fact that he had activity on June 13th isn't enough to say, well, that's the only day that he ever could have been part of it. There was evidence to suggest that he and Mr. Sykes had an ongoing relationship.
I don't see that evidence. I don't see a compelling argument that they had an ongoing operation going on. I cited in the sentencing memorandum to his statement to police for the safety valve interview that he needed to use his truck that day. He said, hey, I got to go make a drug delivery. I'll go do it for you. Can I use the truck then? Sure. That was his explanation. I'll reserve a little more for my rebuttal. Thank you.
That's fine. Ms. Altman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Elizabeth Altman, and I represent the United States in this case. Co-defendants Rodney Sykes and Walter Fox each allege that their advisory guideline range was incorrectly calculated.
Keep your voice up a little bit, please.
Each allege that their guideline range was incorrectly calculated and that their sentence is unreasonable. Each defendant is wrong.
Before you get too much further into that, counsel for Mr. Sykes has said that this would be an appropriate case for Kimbrough limited remand, and I'd like to know the United States' position on that.
Well, Your Honor, I would note that Kimbrough was decided on December 10th of 2007. The defendant's opening brief in this case was filed in February of 2008.
Yes, but we hadn't been doing Kimbrough remands yet. The sentencing was November 21st, 2007. Kimbrough comes out December 10th.
I understand that, Your Honor, but they didn't raise it in their opening brief as well, of this case, in their appellate brief. So Kimbrough had been decided, but it was not raised in their opening brief. If the court's going to consider the case for it not to be waived, even though the case had been decided,
that would not be a waiver situation anyway, as you know. It would be a forfeiture situation.
Whatever it is.
Forfeiture means you overlooked it. Waiver means you stood up and said, I don't want to do this, and they never did that.
I understand that. I don't mean to argue with you, but I know there's also some cases from this circuit that specifically say arguments not waived in opening brief are waived, and this circuit does use the words waived in both situations, which is why it's a little difficult for me to argue which way this should be, because this court treats it both ways. If it is not waived and it is reviewed for plain error, then both of these cases are entitled to a Kimbrough remand. The United States would agree with that.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then I'll still make the other arguments.
No, you should. I mean, because Kimbrough remands are very limited. And if these two aspects were not clearly erroneous, then that would be law of the case. Are erroneous, then that would be law of the case.
And then it's the government's position that they're not clearly erroneous, neither of the evidentiary issues. With regard to Mr. Sykes, it's undisputed that each and every call to arrange for the delivery of crack cocaine in this case was made to Mr. Sykes, and yet he completed only one of the transactions himself. He took all the calls, he arranged the meeting location, he told the undercover officer where to go, and then he had someone deliver the drugs to the undercover officer at that location. It's clear that he was in a decision-making role and a directory role in this case. Additionally, he told the officers...
Well, I think that's one inference you can draw, but you can draw other inferences as well, as he points out in his brief. So the judge didn't have much to say about some of the aspects of the requirements.
While it may be possible to draw another inference from it, I don't believe that overcomes...
Well, I mean, the other inference is all these people were independently selling drugs, and they just... we don't know where the proceeds from the transaction went, so forth.
That is true. Yeah. That is true. But the fact that all the calls were going to Mr. Sykes, he had to get them there somehow. He had to relay the information, and he was the one who was making all of the arrangements. He also, in that interview, as noted, he did tell the officers that he had Mr. Sanderson deliver for him, and he was very, very specific about that. I know there's been some issue about whether he had Mr. Fox, and he kind of backed off from that. But the question says, so if someone calls you to order up dope, and he says, I go myself, yeah, but what happens if you're not able to go? Jamie will run it sometimes. Okay, how often does Jamie run it for you? Every now and then, Jamie would make a run. How often? How many times a week? Maybe three or four times. A week? Yeah. Then there's a discussion, has he been delivering for you pretty much from the beginning? Delivering? Well, making runs from you. And then he says, well, why are we not just doing it together? So in the first part of that, he's very clear that he has another person making runs for him. And then we also see that it seems to occur on the 6/13 date of Mr. Fox's delivery, because Fox had to return to that home to get more drugs to finish a delivery that Sykes had arranged. The first time Fox shows up, he only has 1 8 ball of crack. The officer asks for the second 8 ball. He's seen going back to Sykes' home to get more and then returning back to the officer to complete the delivery. So it appears from the evidence, and the evidence shows that the leader-organizer enhancement was warranted. With regard to Mr. Fox, the district court similarly did not clearly err in finding him responsible for the drugs found in Sykes' home. There is indication that these drugs were in furtherance of the jointly undertaken activity, and that jointly undertaken activity was a conspiracy to sell crack cocaine.
Well, now, what do you say about Application Note 2, which says that the criminal activity jointly undertaken by the defendant is not necessarily the same as the scope of the entire conspiracy, and hence relevant conduct is not necessarily the same for each participant? So is it correct to say that since this conspiracy might have gone on until the whatever the date is, that fulfills the requirement of the joint criminal activity?
No, not necessarily. I think you still need to look at Fox's role in this. But as indicated, there's no indication at all that Fox took any steps to get out of this conspiracy. And he pled guilty to...
Well, that note says that the conspiracy is not necessarily the same thing as the joint criminal activity for this purpose.
I understand that.
Why are we talking... I mean, why should it necessarily fulfill the requirement to say the conspiracy? He didn't opt out of the conspiracy. I don't see where that gets you anywhere.
Well, I think looking at the evidence... It was their jointly undertaken activity was to distribute crack cocaine. And Fox did it with Mr. Sykes on a particular day. And Mr. Sykes says in his interview that Mr. Fox delivered drugs for him on occasion. That was the jointly undertaken activity. And so when those drugs were found, that was the undertaken activity that they were doing together. They were distributing crack cocaine.
So the evidence showed from that one delivery on June 13th that at least on that day, Mr. Fox had access to the house.
Yes.
A key, or it was unlocked or something. I guess they don't know.
Correct.
Why? Because, I mean, you do have to link. I mean, for all I know, Sykes had 10, houses around town. You'd have to say some reason to think that Fox knew that drugs in that quantity would be in that house.
And I think that you can, both from the activities on June 13th and from Sykes' statements immediately following his arrest, where he indicated that they used drugs together and that Fox occasionally sold drugs for him, that Fox would have that knowledge that that's where the drugs would be. With regard to foreseeability...
I think you're saying that they were co-conspirators, and therefore you can attribute all these drugs to all the co-conspirators, but I think this application note doesn't seem to support that.
I am saying they're co-conspirators, and I agree that the application note indicates that you have to look at each person individually. I'm saying that in this case, there's nothing to indicate that they weren't in the jointly undertaken activity, the conspiracy that they were charged with. With regard to the reasonableness, the district court, with regard to Mr. Sykes, indicated that the defendant was incarcerated for a great deal of his adult life, he was engaged in illegal drug use, and he had destroyed lives with his conduct. Similarly, he addressed Mr. Fox's background, he discussed his history, said that he had been in the military, noted he had worked for the post office, and acknowledged that he had turned to drugs during a stressful life.
When he's sentencing Mr. Fox, though, it's a little disturbing, which suggests that this particular judge literally will never go outside the guidelines range. He makes some comment about, well, I'm going to sentence you at the bottom of the range, and that's something this court almost never does, or words to that effect.
He does say words to that effect, and...
I mean, he really can't just...
That's
wed himself to the guideline range in today's world.
When was this event? What's the date?
The sentencing date?
Yeah.
The sentencing date was, I apologize.
I think it's November 21st, 2007.
Right around there, yes.
That's your, you have it in your brief.
Okay, that's enough.
But he did acknowledge all of the factors, and he said it was something that made him go lower than he normally would. And so he has by going lower, taken those factors in consideration. As Judge Cudahy said, the proof is in the pudding. He did do it. The United States would respectfully request this court affirm the defendant's sentences.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Jones, you still had some time?
Thank you, Your Honor. To the extent that I have to utter the words, I would also request a Kimbrough remand, as which was brought up and already discussed. But I'm glad I saved a little bit of time, because I always wondered why it was that everyone was focusing in on the fact that Mr. Fox had to go back to that house. And now I understand it. People actually think that he's got a key to the house and he's going in to get more crack. He's just going back to see Mr. Sykes and get another 8-ball. It's like, hey, dude, you gave me half the stuff that the people told me. I mean, if you're going to send me on an errand, you know, at least give me the right amount. I don't know that there's any evidence that he knows where he keeps it or where it's stashed, and I think that's kind of a leap that I now realize I think people may have thought. And I don't know that that's a fair, I guess, determination, but I had nothing else. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Jones and Ms. Bierman, you were appointed counsel. The court thanks you very much for your assistance to your clients and to the court. We appreciate it very much. Thank you as well. And we will take the case under advisement. Case is under advisement.